Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
The suddenly famous Jenny Lawson is in her ready crouch, which means we're on the air from New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm strangely out of sorts. You know, remember that phrase? They used to use it in to try to sell drugs that had no ability to cure anything specific. You know, if you're out of sorts, I could use one of those today. I don't know, maybe it's just because I was attending a strange, wonderful conference in New Orleans this week about innovation, although it strayed into the area of leadership. Because you need leadership to achieve innovation, don't you? Really? When you stop to think about it? And so at the same time that over my computer is coming the first wave of information on the WikiLeaks material, as they refer to it, there is Dan Senor, former spokesperson for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, and General Stanley McChrystal, both of whom were there when the stuff was happening that is documented in the WikiLeaks material. And, you know, it's just cognitive dissonance. It's just, gee, I wonder, in 1973, was Lieutenant Calley invited to any leadership conferences? Well, was he out of jail yet? Would be the more, or Captain Ernest Mad Dog Medina, for that matter, because he was, I think, Calley's boy. And look it up, kids. Don't ask me. Ladies and gentlemen, news of AFPAC. Wow. Some swell news out of AFPAC this week. U.S.-funded development firms. Yeah, we're outsourcing development, too. They're beginning to shut down their massive reconstruction projects in Iraq and Afghanistan because the Afghan government has refused to rescind its ban on their use of private security guards, like your Blackwaters, now named Z for convenience. The decision to start shuttering the projects, collectively worth hundreds of millions of dollars, could have far-reaching effects on the U.S.-led campaign against the Taliban, according to the Washington Post, disrupting a central component of the strategy to counter the insurgency at a critical moment. Programs to assist Afghan farmers and improve local government, vital to the overall U.S. effort to stabilize the volatile southern and eastern parts of the country, are among those that will be affected, according to officials. The consequence of the ban on development firms employing private guards, quote, will be catastrophic, unquote, said a U.S. official. They are essential to the counterinsurgency strategy. Blackwater has become essential, ladies and gentlemen. That's some good prioritizing. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton this week urged the Pakistani government to boost taxes to pay for flood relief. Taxes on whom? Taxes on the wealthy. Doesn't she know that that's going to hit the Pakistani dry cleaners and other small... Clinton renewed the U.S. commitment to coordinate flood-related assistance to bolster Pakistan, but at a joint press event with a European Union official, Clinton said Pakistan, particularly its wealthy citizens, could do more themselves to deal with the country's problems. Huh. She wouldn't be talking like that over here. She said the international community can only do so much. And we will do less than that. Now, ladies and gentlemen, also on AFPAC, a couple of stories just meant to indicate who's really winning in all of this. Iran, for the first time, joined a U.S. and NATO-dominated coordinating group on Afghanistan on Monday, sending mid-level officials to participate in discussions on coalition, military, and political strategy, including a closed-door report by General Petraeus, reports the Washington Post. Iran's presence, along with representatives from nearly a dozen other Muslim countries, clearly shows this is not a Western or NATO effort, says Germany's envoy for AFPAC. The Iranians watched with interest Petraeus' PowerPoint presentation. So now they know how to do PowerPoint. But they did not speak at the morning session. The Director of Asian Affairs at Iran's foreign minister called for a holistic approach in Afghanistan that would include military, political, and development projects. Well, then let them pay for private security. Speaking of which, New York Times reports today that on at least one occasion, the chief of staff of President Karzai departed Tehran airport loaded down with money delivered to him just before takeoff by Iran's ambassador to Afghanistan. That it's a private slush fund that the Karzai government is using to pay off warlords and others to earn their loyalty inside Afghanistan. And on the other side of the, on the other, way on the other side of Iran, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki this week met with senior Iranian leaders in Tehran. Iran's vision for the next Iraqi government seems to be gaining more traction, reports the Post. Shiite Iran has played a crucial role in Iraqi politics since the invasion. The United States and Iran appear now to be backing the same candidate in Iraq, Prime Minister Maliki, but they have different visions of the government they would like to see. You know, any bets, ladies and gentlemen? Place your bets now. So, who won? Not the Japanese and not the Germans. Hello, welcome to the show.
You're a freckled gal, you're a pug-nosed cutie, sweet as Charlotte Russe. You got big blue eyes, so I ask you why have you dyed your hair chartreuse? Chartreuse,
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 chartreuse.
Though you think it's mighty cute, just wait till the right and tell your ma
that you dyed your hair chartreuse.
Chartreuse,
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 chartreuse.
Though you think it's mighty cute, just wait till the right and tell your ma
that you dyed your hair chartreuse.
In the days of old, when the nights were colder and the girls were truer blue, just think what Pa would have said to Ma had she dyed her hair chartreuse. Chartreuse,
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 chartreuse.
Though you think it's mighty cute, you went too far in that beauty booth
when you dyed your hair chartreuse.
Your hair was black when we lived on Chestnut Street. When you wore pigtails and ginger ale was your most favorite treat. You're a big girl now, so you think it's cuter being fast and fancy loose. But you went too far in that beauty booth when you dyed your hair chartreuse. Chartreuse,
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 chartreuse.
Though you think it's mighty cute, just wait till the right and tell your ma
that you dyed your hair chartreuse.
Chartreuse,
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 chartreuse.
Though you think it's mighty cute, but just wait till the right and tell your ma you didn't like black, you didn't like red, you hated blondes. Well, it's no use. You got mad and dyed your hair.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your brain on the war on drugs. The most violent drug cartel in Mexico, the Zetas. Hey, Zetas, how you doing? No, I'm fine. No problem. They have a fearsome reputation. The real surprise comes not in their ruthless use of violence, reports Al Jazeera, but in the origins of where they learned the tricks of their business. Some of the cartel's founding members were elite Mexican troops trained in the early 1990s by Hans? No, not the German gentleman. Raise your any guesses. By America's 7th Special Forces Group, at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. The Snake Eaters. Hey, Eaters, how you doing? Nope, no problem. That's according to a former U.S. Special Operations Commander. They were given map reading courses, communications, standard special forces training, light to heavy weapons, machine guns, and automatic weapons, says Craig Deer, now a professor at U.S. National Defense University. They came from the Air Mobile Special Forces Group, the GAFE, considered an elite vision, an elite division of the Mexican military. Their U.S. training was designed to prepare them for counterinsurgency and, you'll like this, counter-narcotics operations. They were not taught the most advanced commando techniques available at Fort Bragg. Well, that's probably what ticked them off and got them, you know, sent them on the bad road. Next time, teach them the most advanced techniques. What the hell? And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. And to boil the chair. I'll do those simultaneously because that's how I roll. Couple of surprising items for those who think they know how this whole media thing goes, and I'll read them for you right now. First of all, from AdAge.com, Lindsay Lohan less lucrative for news sites than hard news. What? Newspaper websites get more ad revenue from articles about serious stories like the Gulf oil spill than from traffic bait like stories on celebrity scandals. This is according to an analysis by Perfect Market, a company that aims to help publishers become more visible and profitable on the web. The rise of tools that track top web searches has been increasing web surfers and advertisers' potential influence over editorial judgment. Companies such as Demand Media and Associated Content have been eating up web traffic by assigning articles based on those criteria. But even if newspapers replaced all their editors with algorithms, according to the new analysis, they still wouldn't turn into TMZ overnight. Quote, the trend chasing that people are worried about, the going after the gossip or portraying entertainment as news, is perhaps, not as valuable, says Tim Reuter, chief officer at Perfect Market. It may drive substantial traffic, but that traffic is lower value to news organizations and their advertisers. Articles about unemployment benefits actually brought newspaper sites the most lucrative combinations of traffic and ad revenue this summer. The next most valuable news topics turned out to be, in order, Gulf recovery jobs, the egg recall. Oh, yeah. Remember the egg recall? The Gulf oil spill itself, mortgage rates, jobs in general, President Obama, Social Security, immigration reform, and California's Proposition 8. Lindsay Lohan's trouble with the law, Mel Gibson's rants, and celebrity divorces didn't compare with any of these, according to Perfect Market. Its analysis factored both the amount of traffic that articles got and the ad revenue for those articles for every 1,000 page views. Celebrity scandal was plenty popular, but the ad revenue that came along couldn't match the revenue generated by stories about more sober subjects. See? See, senor. And from Marketing Daily, Crown Imports marketing push to make Corona Light the beer of choice for active men and women aged 21 to 29 is moving into social media with an ambitious Facebook initiative that includes featuring fan photos of fans of Corona beer on a 150-foot digital billboard in Times Square. That's what I miss about New York. The program frankly declares its goal of making Corona Light the, quote, most liked light beer on Facebook. That's what I miss about Facebook. The Facebook popularity campaign is an integral part of Corona Light's new strategy to leverage its appeal to socially engaged young adults who are more focused on exciting activities and experiences than on escaping to a beach, which had been the focus of Corona Light's ad campaign. Exciting activities like Facebook. Speaking of which, also from Marketing Daily, a new study shows that consumers are more likely to show interest in a product if they see that it's already very popular. The research from Oxford University shows that consumers have a herding instinct to follow the crowd once a clear winner is established. However, this instinct appears to switch off almost entirely if the product fails to achieve a certain popularity threshold. The study concludes that while some books and films are highly advertised by the producers, that element is only a small fraction, leaving the great majority of books and films exposed to the forces of social influence. The study is based on analysis of how millions of Facebook users adopted software apps to personalize their Facebook pages. It discovered that once an app had reached a rate of about 55 installations a day, its popularity then soared to reach stellar proportions. A typical app was installed by 1,000 users, but the most popular was in a different league, being adopted by almost 12 million. The study concludes social influence had a key role in whether apps became flops or hits. When the data was monitored, Facebook friends would always be notified if one of their online friends adopted a new app. All Facebook users could also see a list of the most popular apps, so they knew how the global as well as the local community of Facebook friends rated it. According to Felix Reed Chush, Chalkis, from Oxford, users only appear to be influenced by the choices of other users above a certain level of popularity, and at that point, popularity drives future popularity. Below that threshold, the effects of social influence are imperceptible. So if you want to be popular, be real popular. It's just high school all over again, isn't it? The lessons we learn when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, 3 years before Pakistani terrorists struck Mumbai, India, in 2008, federal agents in New York City investigated a tip that an American businessman was training in Pakistan with the group that just happened to execute that attack later on. Previously undisclosed allegations against David Headley, who became a key figure in the plot that killed 166 people, came from his wife after a domestic dispute. In 3 interviews with federal agents, Headley's wife said he was an active militant in the terrorist group Lashkar-e-Taiba, had trained extensively in its Pakistani camps, and had shopped for night vision goggles and other equipment. The wife also told agents that Headley had bragged of working as a paid U.S. informant while he trained with the terrorists in Pakistan. Federal officials say the FBI looked into the tip, but they declined to say what, if any, action was taken. In the 4 years between the wife's warning and Headley's arrest, 11 months after the Mumbai attack, Lashkar-e-Taiba sent Headley on reconnaissance missions around the world. During 5 trips to Mumbai, he scouted targets for the attack using his U.S. passport. In March, he pleaded guilty to charges of terrorism in the Mumbai attacks. He's now cooperating with authorities. So good work, FBI. How far in advance do you need to be warned? Because 4 years apparently wasn't enough. I don't know what it is. It's time for News of the Warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
The development of nitrogen fertilizers has worked wonders for increasing the amount of food in the world, but the results of a new study have revealed how the fertilizers have damaged waterways and the atmosphere, according to Australia's ABC. Scientists say the nitrogen is killing fish by depleting oxygen levels in water and might even be contributing to climate change. We know about the first. That's called the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. As the Earth's population has increased, farmers have increasingly turned to nitrogen fertilizers. Professor Donald Canfield from the University of Southern Denmark is the lead author of a paper outlining the problems in the journal Science. He says the use of nitrogen fertilizers has more than doubled the amount of nitrogen on Earth. Yeah, baby, when you ask what we've done for the Earth, We've doubled its nitrogen. See what I'm saying? Does the Earth thank us? We may have the possibility of fertilizing large tracts of land which wouldn't have been possible to fertilize before, he said. But the bad thing about it is that the nitrogen that is added to the soils often runs off the soils and into coastal areas and into lakes where it eutrophies them. Zap, you are eutrophied. It caused a lot of productivity of algae, which in turn caused the oxygen in these environments to go down to very, very low levels, hypoxia, and caused fish kills. Hello, fish kill. It's a city in New York, town in New York, and all sorts of things. Professor Canfield says other excess nitrogen is being pumped into the atmosphere as the greenhouse gas nitrous oxide. Isn't that laughing gas? He says naturally occurring microorganisms will be able to clean up the excess nitrogen that humans have created, but it will take many decades, and the microorganisms are unionizing, so that's a problem. He says farmers need to stop the runoff of excessive nutrients. It used to be in Denmark that people would fertilize during the fall because that's when they had the fertilizer ready and that's when they could put it on. But by doing so, a lot of the fertilizer was lost and ran off into streams and not used by the plants the next spring. So just timing the fertilization together with the plant growth season can help a lot. Fertilize when the plants are going to grow. And from the British newspaper The Telegraph, CFCs, they were the apparently harmless chemicals once used in aerosol cans, and a host of other everyday objects that threatened to damage life on Earth for, after doing their job, they drifted up into the stratosphere to attack the ozone layer. The chlorofluorocarbons are gone from our lives, banned from industrialized countries by international treaty since the mid-1990s. Developing countries have followed suit. They have begun to decline. They did stick around at dangerous levels in the atmosphere for a while. The world's most authoritative survey, the Scientific Assessment of Ozone Depletion, reported that levels of CFC-12, one of the most common types, have fallen for the first time. The ozone layer over most of the Earth will be back to normal by the middle of the century, except for over Antarctica. Good news for the battle against climate change, says the Telegraph. But treaty that banned CFCs, the most effective international measure governments have ever taken in this climate area. CFCs are powerful greenhouse gases. The substances being used, to replace CFCs, they are HCFCs and HFCs. I remember HFC. Though they're better for the ozone layer, they also contribute to climate change. The use of HCFCs is accelerating. They are due to be phased out by 2030, 10 years earlier than originally intended, thanks to an agreement partially brokered by George W. Bush. But emissions of HFCs are skyrocketing with no end in sight. The new assessment reckons that if uncontrolled, they could undo all the good for the climate that was done by banning the CFCs in the first place. The danger is imminent because China and India are beginning to invest heavily in HFC production, even though safe substitutes are available. So it's chlorofluorocarbons, hexachlorofluorocarbons, and hexachlorofluorocarbons. It's the chlorofluorocarbons. That's the FCs in all of this, isn't it? Sure it is. So if we could just, ladies and gentlemen, just get rid of the FCs, whatever they, CFCs, the FCFCs, the HFCs, the FCCs, we'd be in so much better shape. But will we? You tell me, department. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
See, I told you, even though I said it was the Utah and Lee Department. That's what kind of a hypocrite I am. Ladies and gentlemen, NPR, which stands for nothing, announced this week it had ended its contract with analyst Juan Williams. You know that story. The Associated Press reports that NPR president Vivian Schiller told the Atlanta Press Club that, quote, whatever feelings Williams had about Muslims should be between him and his psychiatrist or his publicist, unquote. Schiller now apologizes for that statement, saying, quote, I spoke hastily, and I apologize to Juan and others for my thoughtless remark, unquote. She has not been fired. I guess you can speak thoughtlessly when you run NPR, just not when you're on it. A Fox News Channel host apologized this week for saying last week that not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslims. Brian Kilmeade said he had misspoke. I don't believe all terrorists are Muslims. I'm sorry about that if I offended or hurt anybody's feelings, he said. That's one if. That's a one-if apology. Kilmeade had made the same statement twice on Friday, hours apart from each other, though. So it wasn't maybe a misspeak. Maybe it was a misspeak. Deadline Melrose, Massachusetts. Massachusetts comedian Lenny Clark apologized on Drive Time Radio this week for an off-color remark he made while performing at a fundraiser for Republican State Senate candidate Greg Spadafora last week. In that appearance, Clark referred to Spadafora's Democratic opponent as a whore. Hey, it's catching on. Good work, Jerry Brown. During an appearance on radio Friday, Clark said he was wrong in telling the joke, adding that his late mother would be ashamed by the performance, and added that he was ashamed of himself as well. She's a lovely woman who I've never met, so there was no malicious intent, he said. I said something I shouldn't have said, and I'd like to apologize to that woman. If I ever meet her in person, I will apologize her in person. So apparently, even professionals can't be trusted with humor these days. Whore. That's funny. Two Escambia County, Florida commissioners publicly apologized this week for laughing and cracking jokes about higher cremation fees for dead obese indigents a week ago. Now, you'd think those are three-time losers, dead obese indigents. But so, quote, I want to publicly apologize to all Escambia County residents who were offended by some comments I made last week, said Commissioner Wilson Robertson. It was never my intent to hurt anyone's feelings. It got a little out of hand, and I apologize. At last Thursday's committee meeting, he had questioned how the indigent poor could become obese and laughingly said, I don't see how indigents can afford groceries. That's good. Commissioner Kevin White also apologized for the incident. The racy photo scandal with the Glee GQ photo shoot, the Glee cast photo shoot, continues with an apology from one of the scantily clad stars. Glee star Diana Agron defended her decision to pose for a risque magazine shoot, but she apologized for causing any offense. So that should take care of that. The creators of South Park, the animated Comedy Central series, apologized this week to the creators of a web comedy video satirizing the summer blockbuster Inception, saying, yes, they had used dialogue from that video. A scene from the South Park satire of the movie Inception used lines lifted from the video satire on collegehumor.com. It's just because we do the show in 6 days and we're stupid and we just threw it together, said Matt Stone. But in the end, there are some lines that we had to call and apologize for. The original video was written by Dan Gurwitch and David Young, loosely modeled on a scene in Inception. South Park episode had a similar scene. But wait, there's more. Dateline Waco, Texas. 10th Court of Appeals Justice Felipe Rain has recused himself from any case involving the entire county of McLennan County and has apologized to McLennan County DA for an angry Facebook posting. Rain's son is challenging the DA. The dust-up started after the DA asked Rain to recuse himself from cases because of Rain's Facebook postings. In support of his son's candidacy, Rain responded he was within his rights to back the candidacy. This is a judge now, and went a step further and sent what was supposed to be a private Facebook message to the DA that didn't stay private. Quote, John, you want to know if my son has ever defended a murder case? Yes, he has, and the verdict was not guilty. Four exclamation points. The person charged with murder and found not guilty will be there tomorrow with the candidate form. John, if you and your sorry ass assistant DA and his wife do not get off my son's ass, it is going to get ugly. Thanks, Felipe. Unquote. A judge, Court of Appeals judge. Rain has now apologized for a message that was both inappropriate in tone and in content. I fully regret those statements. P.S. Rain lost his reelection bid in the Republican primary and will leave his court post at the end of the year. So maybe he's ticked off. Hip-hop mogul. Never thought those words would cross my lips, but here we are. Hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons has apologized to his pal Courtney Love after insulting the singer by calling her a crackhead for posting nude pictures of herself online. And that's enough about that. The government of Ghana intends to send a protest letter to the World Bank over uncomplimentary images of Ghana it displayed at its recent annual meeting in Washington, D.C. Pictures, some of which captured half-naked women breastfeeding their kids and bathing by the road, depict Ghana as a poverty-ridden country. World Bank Country Director Ishak Diwan has apologized for the pictures displayed, which he said were about 20 years old. Ghana looks a lot better now, I believe, he wants me to think. After a year of being in the news, John Gosselin, know who he is? Turned to his Twitter account, know what that is, this week to clear his conscience and get some things off his chest. Quote, I'm acutely aware of the mistakes I made in 2009, and I'm ashamed of the choices I made, he wrote, according to Us magazine. I've apologized to his ex-wife Kate, my family, and to my friends. Through counseling, I have learned to own my actions. My goal is to move forward in a positive direction. Kind of an apology. And Defense Secretary Robert Gates apologized to a Pakistani general this week for the recent deaths of Pakistani border guards in a U.S. helicopter strike. The deaths prompted the Pakistanis to temporarily close a crossing used by trucks hauling material to NATO troops from Pakistan into Afghanistan. Gates called the deaths unintentional, said the Pentagon spokesman. He said the officials discussed ways of improving military coordination going forward. That's where we're going. Forward. That's where we're led by the apologies of the week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
There is beauty in the bellow of the blast. There is grandeur in the growling of the gale. There is eloquent outpouring when the lion is a-roaring and the tiger is a-lashing of his tail.
Yes, I like to see a tiger from the Congo or the Niger, and especially when lashing of his tail.
Volcanoes have a splendor that is grim, and earthquakes only terrify the dolts. But to him who's scientific, there is nothing that's terrific in the falling of a flight of thunderbolts.
Yes, in spite of all my meekness, if I have a little weakness, it's a passion for a flight of thunderbolts.
If that is so, sing Derry Down Derry, it's evident very artists are one. Away we'll go, and melody, marry not, tolerate, tarry till the day is done.
In extreme old age, do you fancy you are elderly enough? Information I'm requesting on a subject interesting is a maiden all the better when she's tough.
Throughout this wide dominion, it's the general opinion she'll last a good deal longer if she's tough.
Are you old enough to marry, do you think? Won't you wait until you're 80 in the shade? There is fascination frantic and a ruin that's romantic. Do you think you are sufficiently decayed?
To the matter that you mention, I have given some attention, and I think I am sufficiently decayed.
That is so, sing Derry Down Derry, it's evident very artists are one. Away we'll go, and merrily marry not tardily, tarry till the day is done. If that is so, sing Derry Down Derry, it's evident very artists are one. Away we'll go, and merrily marry not tardily, tarry till the day is done. Sing Derry Down Derry, we'll merrily marry not tardily, tarry till the day is done.
This is Le Show from New Orleans. Ladies and gentlemen, let's dig into this wonderful financial environment we're in a little bit. Wouldn't you like to? Wouldn't that make your day just so much smiley facer? Here's an interesting statistic. In the stock market of today, automated trading, computer-driven, algorithmically determined trading of stocks, is so dominant, 70% of stock purchases last, that is to say, the stocks are held, the stocks in those purchases are held for an average of 11 seconds. Short-term bets, very short. 11 seconds, ladies and gentlemen. Can you trade that fast? What happened to those day traders? I bet they couldn't trade that fast. So now the new F-bomb is for foreclosures. The foreclosure bomb is, well, Bank of America announced this week that it had lifted its restriction on foreclosing. Wells Fargo said its business shows no signs of the looming crisis that some analysts fear from shoddy lending and foreclosure practices. That assertion by Wells Fargo chairman John Stumpf appeared at odds with a March deposition in which a Wells Fargo vice president of loan documentation described engaging in the art of robo-signing. The vice president, Zi Mua, said she signed as many as 500 documents in 2 hours, attesting to the accuracy of foreclosure paperwork, although she neither verified the information nor understood the statement she was signing. Checking the numbers, quote, was not part of my job description, she said. Some analysts predict Bank of America and other big banks could be forced to issue huge refunds to investors, people who bought mortgage-backed securities, because the banks misrepresented the quality of loans or bungled the paperwork when they pooled the loans into securities. Wells Fargo, though, says it has appropriate documents. There is a company called DocX, D-O-C-X, which advertises on the Internet that it will recreate missing documents in chain of title. They've been used by many of the banks to do so. And Dateline Jacksonville, Florida. The Jacksonville Times-Union has reviewed documents where the same name with obviously different signatures was used to certify that papers were served to homeowners. This indicates that there is a foreclosure summons scandal in Florida. There's no simple way to know how often every type of irregularity occurs. There's documentation showing a sharp rise in instances where summons entrusted to servers have been reported as lost. They have skyrocketed, making it harder to document the fate of important paperwork. Critics attribute the problems to both sloppiness and fraud. Tammy Lou Capusta, a paralegal in a foreclosure law firm, described the serving process as, quote, a complete mess. Renters were served rather than property owners. An affidavit of service would be filed when the summons hadn't been served, she said. And other sources indicate that banks routinely, when mortgages were first issued, would shred the paperwork once they filed with an electronic service. And as the mortgages were divided and pooled into securities and traded from here to there. Sometimes the chain of title was broken. The note, the lien, the IOU, all of it, the mortgage, never appeared. Hence the need for document recreation. In other words,
you know, if this was the Middle Ages, I just found the Holy Grail. Yeah, I'm in the banking business, and I'm way too big to fail. I can act like with a sudden without the fear of jail. See, mortgages were boring, lending money one house at a time. But all sliced up and packaged, they could start to look real brown. All the paperwork was virtual, that was a feature, not a crime. See, we were blowing up a bubble, no need for notes and IOUs. Now we're tiptoeing through the rubble of the just some messy paperwork. Couple million mortgages sailed right through our machine. Didn't need to keep the notes, didn't need to leave. When everything's on trust, you can keep the office nice and clean. Now other banks bought our packages, just piling up the debt. So we bought some of theirs. Everything was net. Then we all got some insurance just to hedge the bet. We were blowing up a bubble, no need for notes and IOUs. Now we're tiptoeing through the rubble of the just some messy paperwork blues. And someone pulls a ripcord, someone makes some music, and we crank out foreclosures with help from a robo-signing friend. But before we sell the houses, here come some lawyers round the bend. Hey, you don't need to read the documents. Couldn't find them if we tried. Oh, we got some recreated. With a notary public on the side. But hey, we just paid commissions. They're the folks that lied. We were blowing up a bubble, no need for notes and IOUs. Now we're tiptoeing through the rubble of the just some messy paperwork blues. So now the bonds are in the toilet, the mortgages have got a taint. Some attorney general's begun to swear out a complaint. You think that I'd be worried? Glad to tell you that I ain't. No, I ain't. 'Cause when the boat takes on water, I'm not the one you want to drown. Got the trust of my colleagues, got the keys to the town. Still too big to fail, so I'm not going down. We were blowing up a bubble, no need for notes and IOUs. Now we're tiptoeing through the rubble of the just some messy paperwork blues. Blues.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Bill Clinton lost the secret codes that would be used to authorize a U.S. nuclear strike during the last year of his presidency. According to a new book quoted in the Financial Times, General Hugh Shelton, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs under Clinton, says the codes were lost for months, leaving the U.S. unable to launch its nuclear weapons. This is the one point in the system where there is no backup, and it failed, he says. And the buried lead of the story, Colonel Robert Patterson, who wrote in a book of his own that Clinton lost the codes during 1998, quotes Clinton as saying, "I don't have mine on me. I'll track it down, guys, and get back to you." He adds that on other occasions, Clinton had misplaced the codes, which he attached by a rubber band to credit cards in his wallet. The president doesn't carry cash, you see. From the Telegraph, the author Stieg Larsson, you know, the guy who writes all the girl books, wrote all the girl books, like The Girl with the Golden Franchise. He spent a year training female guerrillas, not gorillas, guerrillas in Africa. The Swedish crime writer traveled to Africa where he taught Eritrean women how to fire grenade launchers. His close friend John Henry Holmberg has divulged the information in a chapter of a new book. In it, Holmberg describes how Larsson trained a group of women who were part of a Marxist liberation group fighting for Eritrea's independence from Ethiopia. Nutty, huh? This is Dateline Australia from The Age. The Taliban have overwhelmed foreign troops and cannot be defeated by military means, according to one of Australia's top combat soldiers. Brigadier Mark Smethurst says securing Afghanistan could take decades, but success is uncertain without a fundamental change in strategy. His assessment comes in a report that contrasts sharply with claims of progress in Afghanistan by his and other governments. The Afghan army, he says, cannot operate independently despite 7 years of training, and the police are even worse. The Afghan government is ineffective and has failed to deal with corruption, human rights abuses, and a non-existent justice system. Aid distribution, he says, has been wasteful, ineffective, and insufficient. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, Brigadier Mark Smethurst implicitly criticizes the approach of the previous government and the present government. He implies that if Australia hasn't achieved its primary goal by 2012, training Afghan troops, they should pull out. Compared with other counterinsurgency campaigns, he writes, the chance of a solution in the short term appears remote. Even with the strongest possible action and cooperation at the national level, it is difficult to see solutions emerging in less than 10 years unless proactive action is taken now. Unquote. Brigadier Smethurst is a highly regarded special forces officer with service in East Timor, Iraq, and Afghanistan. This paper was written last year. He says that basic tenets hold true today. A wave of targeted attacks on soldiers, police, traffic officers, and senior officials is steadily picking off the custodians of Iraq's streets at rates that are nearing the darkest days of the insurgency. As of last week, 710 Iraqis had been killed this year with silenced pistols or rifles. At least 600 more had been killed by magnet bombs placed under the cars of officials. The killings have increased sharply in the past 4 months amid fears that the ongoing failure to form a government is fueling a worsening security vacuum. The WikiLeaks material you may have heard about, this is a facet you may not have heard about. Just right by contrast, from the British newspaper The Guardian. A prisoner kneeling on the ground, blindfolded and handcuffed, when an Iraqi soldier walked over to him and kicked him in the neck. A U.S. Marine sergeant was watching and reported the incident which was duly recorded and judged to be valid. The outcome, quote, no investigation required. This is fairly common. According to the logs, this is the impact of Frago 242. A Frago is a fragmentary order which summarizes a complex requirement. This one issued in June 2004 orders coalition troops not to investigate any breach of the laws of armed conflict, such as the abuse or torture of detainees, unless it directly involves members of the coalition. Excluded, of course, would be Iraq. Where the alleged abuse is committed by Iraqi on Iraqi, only an initial report will be made. No further investigation will be required, unless directed by HQ. Frago 242 appears to have been issued as part of the wider political effort to pass the management of security from the coalition to Iraqi hands. In effect, it means that the regime has been forced to change its political constitution, but allowed to retain its use of harsh or torturous methods. In the WikiLeaks material, ladies and gentlemen. And, by contrast, in its most extensive death tally of the Iraq War, the U.S. military says nearly 77,000 Iraqi civilians and security officials were killed from early 2004 to mid-2008. That total falls well below Iraqi government figures, but it was issued by our own military. First time it's done that, based on raw data. The largest release of raw data by the U.S. military to detail deaths during the Iraq War. So we release raw data, but we don't have Julian Assange to lead us. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Thank you.
Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the good news for Juan Williams is he can always buy an underwriting announcement on NPR, because they won't censor... That concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up in the east... up and down, I say, the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world, via the internet, on your computer, at two different locations, live and archived at harryshearer.com. Available on your smartphone through Stitcher.com. A shout out to the Stitcher guys, Stitcher people. Available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And it'd be just like Lieutenant Calley appearing at a leadership conference, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Look him up, kids. Tip of the Le Show Chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks to Pam Halstead, as always, and to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans for making today's show plausible. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist for the music heard here on, pretty much all is available at harryshearer.com. Check it out. And the show is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. Information on where you can see The Big Uneasy, like people did here in New Orleans at the film festival this week, at TheBigUneasy.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.